Well, welcome everybody, and a good day to you all. Well, it's a good evening here in the UK, this side of the pond, and a good afternoon to you listening in the Americas. My name is Martin Kiernan. I'm a nurse consultant in infection prevention control from Southport here in the UK. It is my great pleasure to host this, which is the 35th Web Training Teleclass of the year, bringing colleagues around the world exceptional training, both in terms of volume and quality, for the last 10 years. Today's teleclass will be no exception, and it is my great honour to introduce Dr. Fidelma Fitzpatrick to you. Fidelma is a consultant microbiologist working at the Beaumont Hospital, and she also works at the Health Service Executive Health Protection Surveillance Centre in Dublin in Ireland. Today's topic is one that has been much in the forefront over the past couple of years, and I look forward to hearing what Fidelma has to say as she takes us through the practical issues in infection prevention during a pandemic. Fidelma, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Martin. First of all, I'm very honoured to be in such illustrious company for this year's programme, and I hope everybody that's listening finds this a useful lecture. The second slide is a quick introduction in case you don't know where I am. I live in the Republic of Ireland, and on the left there is our flag. You don't see it very much in the Olympics, but hopefully in the upcoming Rugby World Cup you might see it a little bit. On your right is a map of the far end of Europe, and we're that green small island almost falling into the Atlantic. So if you're based on the east coast of North America or even in Brazil and you look out your window and wave out, you might just see me. We've a very small population, only 4.2 million, a young population, and we've two languages, English and also Irish, and we're an EU member. So next slide. Our healthcare system is a mixed public and private system. HSE stands for the Health Services Executive. And we've a lot of small hospitals. For a small country, we've 51 public hospitals. And that's probably a legacy of our religious orders, because they started a lot of our hospitals. In recent years, we've had an external regulator of our healthcare system, and that's the Health Information and Quality Authority. And they produce standards and inspect us against them, and that's a really good progress in our healthcare system. Next slide. In terms of influenza, even though we don't have a lot of very fancy surveillance systems, we do have a lot of information. So even before the pandemic and every year, we get some information for a lot of different sources. And this is really a busy slide, but just to show you that we really rely a lot on our colleagues in primary care, our colleagues in the virology laboratories and the public health departments. And where I work, one of the places I work in the HPSC, the Health Protection Surveillance Centre, is the national centre that collates all that information. And HPSC sends in information into the European Centre of Disease Control, that's ECDC, to the WHO, and also within Ireland. So next slide. And this is just an example of the type of information that HPSC send. This is our GP influenza-like illness, that's ILI, consultation rates. So as a hospital doctor, I would get this type of information every week, specifically during flu season. So to introduce my lecture is going to be based on a lot of personal experience from the last pandemic, which I hope you find useful for the next. So we're on slide 6 now, apologies. I'm going to focus on healthcare settings and specifically on hospital issues, because that's really where my experience is. And I'm going to talk through the hierarchy of risk controls. This may be familiar to you, but I found it very, very useful to keep everybody's head sane in the middle of all the fuss. And I'm going to end with some thoughts for the future. So next slide. In terms of disclosures, while I don't have any commercial disclosures, my big disclosure is that I'm not a flu expert. I do have two hats, and I will probably wear both of my hats during this lecture. I am a jobbing consultant clinical microbiologist in an Irish hospital, and my job varies from managing the laboratory to seeing patients and doing daily rounds of the intensive care unit. I also direct the Infection Prevention and Control Service. During the pandemic flu, I had a national remit. I was co-opted onto the Department of Health expert group, not necessarily because I was a flu expert, but for advice on infection prevention and control. So as I go through this lecture, I'll talk about my practical lessons that I learned. So next slide is practical issue number one. And it's very important. It's coping, because life does go on. Next slide. During a pandemic, which is P-A-N-D-E-M-I-C, next slide, we sometimes forget there's a D-E-M there. There's a lot of panic. Next slide. So in terms of practical aspects, infection control really has to cope in the real world. The hospital doesn't just close down and the rest of the other patients don't stop coming in just because we happen to have a pandemic. Also, patients don't come in boxes. They don't come with clear-cut presentations. And despite any of our best efforts, there will never, unfortunately, be 100% compliance with infection prevention control measures all the time. Next slide. So in terms of coping, well, there's a lot of things to cope with, especially early on. Nobody knows what the specific virus is. Nobody really knows how it's transmitted. There's a lot of delay in diagnosis, especially early on when we don't have the appropriate laboratory tests. And we're very aware there may be little of any native immunity. We're not sure about mortality. We can't rely on a vaccine. And we know that nearly everything will be in short supply. And this will be fed by lots of panic and rumours, etc. And the bottom line there in red is the hospital does not stop admitting non-flu patients. So we've got huge demands on our infection control resources, both infrastructure and supplies, but also personally, we need to look after ourselves. So definitely we need two types of approaches, and this brings me on to the next slide. Certainly early on when you don't know much, and then you adapt it as evidence and experience emerges. But that number two can sometimes be very difficult because there's multiple copies of documents circulating. And it's sometimes easier said than done to get a clear message out to everybody without documentation overload and burnout. So for example, during the pandemic flu, as a hospital doctor, I would get a huge amount of emails every day from the National Centre where I worked on top of my own emails. So it was very difficult to try and get through all that mess. So that's the practical issue number one, coping. Practical issue number two is the fact that it's not all about masks. And I apologize, I skipped through a slide here because that was to remind me that I'm hoping that this approach will also help outside a pandemic because every flu season we are faced with the same challenges. So practical issue number two, it is not all about masks. Again, easier said than done. At some of the early national committee meetings that I attended, everybody was discussing masks, masks, and masks until one of my occupational health colleagues sat back and said, well, why don't you do this in the context of the hierarchy of risk controls? So that's the next slide. And while I had heard about this, I'd never appreciated what a useful tool it was in getting us to concentrate our efforts on what was really important. And there's five elements to the hierarchy of risk controls, starting number one with elimination and lastly with personal protective equipment. And the idea is you don't jump straight to number five unless you've done one to four. And that's exactly what we were doing initially. We were jumping straight to number five and talking about masks without practically going through the other four stages. So that's going to be the focus of this talk. So the first part of the hierarchy of risk controls, and onto the next slide in red, is elimination. So next slide. Elimination is the most powerful control, and that's why it's number one. Next slide. So how can you actually eliminate exposures? Well, we do this a lot in our day-to-day life, but we don't realize that we're doing this and it's so important. So for example, during the pandemic, we set up telephone helplines so that patients that were at home with influenza-like illness could phone. We tried to minimize outpatient visits and postpone elective visits and procedures. One of the other reasons we had to do that is from a coping strategy for the hospital. We didn't have enough beds. Visitor management's also important, and I'm not sure about in your country, but in Ireland we're still very family orientated. So when somebody is in hospital, several members of the family and extended family will always come and visit. And that can be quite a challenge in a country like ours. Trying to say to people, please don't visit a healthcare facility. Limit people for patients in isolation and to stop our visitors wandering around the hospital. You can't blame them at times, it is boring. But we had to try and get that message out. Also practically make sure visitors weren't present during aerosol generating procedures. So it was important to get the message out to visitors, but also to staff. Next slide. So that's elimination. And we had to really focus our minds on, actually, this is the most powerful control. We have to get this right first before jumping up and down about the next. Well, number two, next slide, is substitution. And it's usually not an option in this context. But number three is isolation and engineering controls. So next slide. Isolation is really to protect the other patients and the other staff members. And patients with suspected or confirmed influenza, as we all know, should be isolated in a single room or cohorted. Again, next slide, easier said than done. Certainly in our hospitals, we don't have 100% single rooms, and we still have 6- and 8-bedded wards, plus very crowded emergency departments. So this was easier said than done. Next slide. The other challenge is that the clinical signs and symptoms can be nonspecific. Certainly, there was delays in diagnosis, and in my hospital, our virology was off-site. And as I said from the start, there is non-flu patients that still need isolation. So in order to get this type of control up and running, we needed clear policies and procedures, and they had to cover 24 hours, 7 days a week. They had to cover the ED, the emergency department, our general practitioners, GPs, and the ward. Like a lot of countries, if we didn't have enough single rooms, we had to make very clear risk assessments as to who was taking priority over whom. And we had to make sure that we'd very clear documented risk assessments and to help to guide our own staff. Communication is so important. And document control was definitely very important. Certainly, we weren't very successful at times in this because at times there was far too many versions of the same document. And we also had to make sure they're easy accessible. Maybe in your country, staff have very good access to the internet, but not in all of my hospitals. So next slide. Engineering controls are probably more self-evident. But again, we found these easier said than done. Trying to get physical barriers in the emergency department to sort of reduce or eliminate exposures, and that was to shield staff and other patients from potentially infected patients. So we had barriers such as partitions and sometimes just simply curtains drawn. We certainly, in the intensive care unit, attempted to reduce exposures to specific procedures like closed suctioning systems, and then within air handling systems, which I won't go into. So that is the third risk control. So next slide. Number four is administrative controls. And again, we hadn't really initially concentrated so much on this. We were jumping up and down about masks. So next slide. So what are these? Well, they do what they say on the tin, but they need to be implemented consistently. And it needs to cover everybody, our hospital management, staff, and patients. And really, in the context of flu, the administrative controls are our standard and transmission-based precautions, specifically hand hygiene, respiratory hygiene, cough etiquette, enforcing exclusion of ill healthcare workers, and vaccination. And I'll talk a little bit about vaccination. Next slide. Certainly, the first thing is we need to educate our patients and let them know what to do. So they need to know that if they have symptoms of ILI or ILI, influenza-like illness, they need to let staff know They need to know where to sit, so there should be a segregated area, and they also need to know when to use a face mask and hand hygiene. So next slide, slide 30, is an example of one of the posters, and you probably had very similar posters in your emergency department and general practitioners' surgeries. Slide 31 is about education, and certainly in Ireland, we've got much more multicultural in the last 10 years. English isn't everybody's first language, and neither is Irish. So we had to make sure we had visual alerts in several different languages on places that patients would arrive. So strategic places like the waiting areas and the coffee shop. And we also needed to change them frequently, not that our patients were there a lot, but really for our staff, so that our staff noticed them. And we had several posters, which I'll show you examples of respiratory and cough etiquette and hand hygiene. So slide 32 gives you an example of two of them. Two of these I do like because they're quite simple, specifically the one on the right, catch it, bin it, kill it. We ended up having school children coming home, teaching their parents how to do this. Slide 33 are two other information leaflets I'm less fond of, not that they're not good, but I think there's too much information. On the right, we have frequently asked questions for patients that we put up on our HPSC website. So slide 34, we're still on these controls, is it's fair enough to tell patients what to do, but we have to make sure there's enough supplies. You can't say to a patient, use a face mask, if there ain't any face masks there. So we need supplies of face masks, hand hygiene products, and or sinks, certainly on arrival, and in strategic places, including the emergency department, radiology, and phlebotomy. And also at the first point of call in the emergency department, but also in a primary care setup, there does need to be a method to identify symptomatic patients. So, for example, at registration, a standard questionnaire inquiring about influenza-like illness, and if a patient has it, provide instructions to the administrative person that's behind the desk as what to tell the patient what to do. And likewise, something in triage so these patients can be separated. So slide 35 talks about infrastructure, and I have a question mark beside enough space. Because space is always an issue, especially when you have a crowded emergency department or primary care centre. And you do try to ask patients with influenza-like illness to sit as far away from others as possible, preferably separate waiting areas. Indeed, it's part of our standard precautions. But in our hospitals, this wasn't always practical because, again, a lot of our hospitals in Ireland are very old. We don't have a lot of new modern hospitals, and some of the emergency departments are quite small. So slide 36 asks the question, what about ill healthcare workers? Certainly, we needed very clear policies for this, not just in a pandemic, but also outside a pandemic, and good communication, and specifically good communication between infection control, occupational health, management, and staff. And the message needs to get out to staff, don't come in if you're sick. And if you are in and you are sick, stop your patient care activities, put on a face mask, and let your supervisor in infection control know. But this is very difficult at times to implement, specifically in professional groups, including my own, like doctors. Doctors and nurses tend to be very reluctant to leave work because they are aware that their colleagues have to do their work. And yet we keep having to say to them and remind them, this isn't about you, it's about your patients. If you're sick, you could infect them. Next slide, and that's the point of this slide, slide 37. We really need to get the message out to convince our colleagues that actually they're protecting patients better by not coming into work or going home. Slide 38 comes to practical issue number 4, and it's the whole issue of vaccination, which is easier said than done even outside of flu season. Because even if you do get a vaccine, and it's a logistical issue to try and get it out to staff, how do you get staff to take it? Next slide. Because we know that we're outside of a pandemic, as healthcare workers, we're very poor at taking up on our flu vaccine. So in a pandemic, availability is delayed, but we do know from seasonal flu the uptake is poor. And why is this so poor? And I've a few studies at the bottom of the slide, but there's loads of this in the literature. And apologies for the abbreviations. HCW stands for healthcare worker. Certainly, as healthcare workers, we know we're at higher risk for acquiring influenza because we're dealing with the patients. However, we can also get flu in the community where we can't rely on PPE or personal protective equipment. It's critical from a practical end of things that we don't get sick because we need to keep the show on the road. If you don't have staff, the hospital won't work. And we also have to keep reminding ourselves that we can't depend on our patients responding because some of our patients, like our elderly patients, don't respond very well. Also, in general, as healthy adults, asymptomatic infection is very common in healthcare staff. So sometimes we may not even know we have flu and we're putting our patients at risk. Next slide. So why is it so poor when we know what to do? And this is quite a nice paper in Current Opinion in Infectious Diseases that explored this issue. And there's lots of different reasons. Lack of knowledge. Some very well-educated staff still think they can get flu from the vaccine. There's safety concerns, some of which aren't unreasonable. There's also a belief that some healthcare workers don't think they're going to get the flu, neither do they think they're going to get complications. Sometimes it's a bit inconvenient. We're all very busy. We're rushing home. We're rushing into work. We're rushing around. We can't get the vaccine. Some of us really doubt whether it's of any use at all. And some, we don't think it's going to help protect patients. And also, there's a certain amount of misinformation about the risk of asymptomatic infection to patients. And what's quite interesting in this paper, they note that increased patient contact, belief of being at high risk of infection, concerns about transmitting flu to patients, meant that staff were more willing to get vaccinated. So that's how we need to get that message across. Next slide. This is just an example from our website of a frequently asked questions for healthcare workers. And we put this up over the last few years to try and demystify some common myths. Next slide. So what can be done? And there's a huge amount of literature on this. And indeed, it was interesting for me because it wasn't literature I was very familiar with. My occupational health colleagues were much more familiar. Lots of different studies. Some hospitals have electronic databases. Most hospitals involve in education, including my own hospital. Local champions, that's high-profile people. So, for example, in my hospital recently for flu season, we're planning to put some key directors of medicine, directors of surgery, take their photo getting the vaccine to try and encourage staff to get the vaccine. Marketing campaigns and incentives. Indeed, our occupational health physician offered chocolate with vaccine last year. The screensavers I mentioned. Also providing vaccines on the ward. Because everybody's busy, it's sometimes difficult to expect staff to come to you. So in my hospital, our occupational health team come to the wards. In some countries, especially in North American countries, there's declination statements, and then the issue of mandatory vaccination. And I'm going to explore that briefly because I think it's quite interesting. It's part of this risk control. The declination statement, there's a fair bit of literature on that, and it's those that refuse vaccination are asked to sign a statement to say that they understand the rationale for the vaccine and the risks involved with refusal. But certainly the data on the efficacy of this is mixed, and it definitely generates a huge amount of paperwork. And what was interesting is when some of the studies have examined the reasons why people were declining, it was a lot of misinformation, such as they were on chemotherapy or they were immunosuppressed. And that indeed is a reason to get it rather than not to get it. In one US study where they looked at mandatory vaccination, they noticed that fewer staff members had sought exemptions than had signed declination statements the previous year. So the issue of declination statements is interesting. It certainly raises awareness among staff as to why they should get vaccinated, and it gives occupational health professions a reason to open a dialogue with staff as to and correct some misinformation. But I think practically it does seem to generate a lot of paperwork, and certainly in a hospital like mine that would be an issue. So the next slide, slide 44. What about mandatory vaccination? You can have two reactions to this. Absolutely appalling, and it's an infringement on your personal rights, or absolutely right, we should protect our patients. And most of the information on this seems to be from North American studies. Certainly there's nothing on this, from this from Ireland. One US study, the one in clinical infectious diseases at the bottom of that slide, it was a US healthcare group of hospitals, long-term care facilities, that's LTCF, and a daycare centre. And what's interesting from the start is this hospital group had a reasonable baseline for vaccination. Certainly 71% of their staff were vaccinated. That's high now compared to my hospital. They made it mandatory. They made it a condition of employment and a patient safety initiative. And they got 98% vaccination rate, which was quite remarkable, with a few exemptions. What I found interesting was the pregnancy was permitted as an exemption, and it's an indication in our country for flu vaccination. The other thing I found interesting is that if employees didn't get vaccinated and weren't exempted, they were fired. Next slide. Another study looked at this, a five-year US study of mandatory vaccination. And again, staff had exemptions on religious and medical grounds, and if they were exempted, they had to wear a mask. And again, in that table, their results are remarkable, almost 100% coverage. But it wasn't just the mandatory vaccination. They also had good infrastructure, they had good IT, they had good storage, they had good staffing levels. They had strong leadership and champions. Indeed, when they started it off, they had a big party with the local football team to publicise it. They had lots of education, and they also had mobile carts to the wards, peer vaccinators, and they had extended occupational health, that's OHRs, with lots of free coffee. I don't know about you, but a bit of free coffee and chocolate sometimes helps when you're tired in a hospital. Next slide. What was interesting in this paper is they described the following. Employees, inpatient nurses, filed a grievance, those that were in a union, and the arbitrator found in their favour, and their decision was upheld on appeal, which basically meant that inpatient nurses who belonged to a union didn't have to get vaccinated. But despite this, they all did. So nearly 96% of them got vaccinated, even though they didn't have to. And I think for me, what I'm taking out of that is the lesson of peer pressure. If everybody else is doing it, there's a good chance you're going to do it also. Next slide, slide 47. So what works? And I think this is important to explore because it is one of our risk controls. And we know we should do it. It's a bit like not smoking and not eating lots of junk food. There's lots of misconceptions. There certainly is a lack of knowledge, even though we as healthcare workers are meant to have that knowledge. And it's clear that education alone doesn't work. Certainly multiple things seem to work, and I suspect it has to be adapted not just nationally, but also locally. Clear leadership is important, as is good infrastructure with good communication. Incentives help, and certainly accountability. And some papers suggest picking a target and then if nothing else works, making it mandatory. However, certainly in my country, we're a little bit away from that. Next slide. In 2010, SHEA, the Society of Healthcare Epidemiology of America, had a position statement where they said universal staff vaccination was the cornerstone of a comprehensive national effort to prevent the spread of influenza. And certainly, I would very much support this, but I have an issue with the issue of mandatory vaccination, probably more on a personal liberties end of things. Next slide. So we've now gone through four risk controls, and we're only now getting to the one that certainly in my country we talked about the most, and it generated the most discussion. So if I had to stop at this stage, actually, we would probably have a lot of flu control sorted. So what about number five, PPE, personal protective equipment? It has to be the last resort because it is risk control number five, and it's certainly only as effective as the training, supervision, and compliance with it. And certainly the level of protection chosen has to be appropriate to the hazard and informed by risk assessment. The hazard in this case is influenza. Next slide. And this is the bit everybody get hung up about. It's your risk control, your mask, will depend on the mode of transmission. And there's a huge amount of debate as to what is the exact mode of transmission about influenza. Is it contact, droplet, airborne, or a mixture of the all? Next slide, slide 52. And it's really what I have in red, airborne. The role of airborne transmission is very much debated. Next slide. I'm going to talk you through what we did in the pandemic. The first question we had is there a need for contact precautions? Now, we knew from the literature that certainly influenza can survive on surfaces, and it can be transferred from surfaces to hands, and it can certainly survive on hands. Next slide. So transmission is possible via contact. But you would kind of think that hand hygiene should address this. Next slide. In our pandemic, we decided to go with contact precautions, principally because a lot of children were coming in with diarrhea, so we had a good reason to institute contact precautions. Next slide. Slide 56. Is it droplet or is it airborne? And like everything in life and in medicine, this isn't in a box. The line between them is blurred, and it's frequently a mixture of two. Droplets are large, they can't reach your lower airways, they don't stay suspended for ages, and they're propelled a short distance. Whereas airborne spreads, or airborne droplet nuclei, are much smaller. They can remain suspended in air and travel over a distance and remain infective. Next slide. And really what we're talking about here is practical issue number five, masks or respirators. Next slide. So a face mask is a loose-fitting disposable device. We have lots of them in our healthcare institutions. And they're designed to trap respiratory secretions expelled by the wearer to prevent others getting it. And they really block large particle droplets. They're certainly not designed to prevent inhalation of airborne particles. Next slide. Whereas a respirator does just that. It's designed to reduce exposure to airborne contaminants and filter airborne particles, though it still blocks the splashes, the sprays, and the large droplets. The whole point of a respirator is it's designed to achieve a close facial fit, and that's really very important because it has to fit correctly, and it is sometimes very difficult to tolerate, and it's certainly more expensive. Next slide. Certainly, one Australian study looked at the idea of choosing respirators, and they quite rightly concluded that the choice of respirator has to be guided by rigorous fit testing rather than comfort or price. And facial characteristics are very important, as is the training of the fit tester. And you have to also know how staff that are using the respirator know how to fit check. And this was certainly a big issue for us in our country, is that we didn't have a program of fit testing nationally that we knew was robust. And it's something that we aimed to improve after the pandemic. Next slide. And this is just an example of some of the posters we produced. I'm sure you had something similar for your staff, for instructions on how to put on personal protective equipment and also to remove it. So we're back to this issue of masks or respirators. And even though I started off saying that I shouldn't dwell too long on this because it's a small part of the risk controls, it's an important part and it's something that everybody talks about. So we're meant to be informed by evidence. So what is the evidence? Can that help us? What about evidence to support droplet spread, i.e. we should be using masks? There's certainly evidence from surveillance and from plane studies. For example, point two on slide 63 talks about a plane going from the US to Hong Kong, where a tourist became symptomatic on the plane and then spent 3 days on a tour bus with about 30 others. There was only 9 secondary cases, 8 in the tour group and 1 airplane passenger, and all cases were within 2 rows of the index case and a secondary case. And all those infected tour members had close contact, and there was certainly an increased risk with the increased duration of conversation. Nobody else got it. So there's lots of these type of studies in the literature citing that droplet transmission is probably the predominant mode of transmission. However, on slide 64, conversely, there's also some studies in the literature, and an increasing number of these, that shows that the virus can survive as an aerosol. Certainly it can survive in air. Humidity has a role. Different strains have different survival characteristics. And there is some good animal studies from ferrets and mice showing that aerosol transmission may be important. So, for example, on bullet point 3, the first sub-bullet point there, is a study where infected ferrets transmitted to other ferrets in a separate cage connected by a tube with directional airflow. Similar studies in mice and similar studies in guinea pigs. So we're not mice and guinea pigs, but certainly from animal studies, there is a suggestion that aerosol transmission may be important. I quoted you data from planes for droplet transmission. On slide 65, there is data from planes to support potential airborne transmission, including a symptomatic passenger, H3N2, was sitting near the lavatory or the toilet. The plane was delayed, the ventilation was off, and the majority of the passengers and crew developed symptoms within a short time period of flight. So next slide. So we've now shown some evidence for droplet and evidence for airborne. What about masks? Well, again, there's an observational study quoted on slide 66 that showed there was no increase in acquisition of pandemic flu by healthcare workers using surgical masks in Singapore when compared with those using the N95 masks. Slide 67, well, this is the JAMA paper that a lot of people breathed if they had chosen surgical masks, pardon the pun, a huge sigh of relief. This was a multi-center randomized trial. I think it's a very important trial, where they compared surgical mask versus the N95 and looked at protection of healthcare workers against flu in the 2008-09 season in 8 tertiary care hospitals. The participants were nurses, and they were instructed to use masks or respirators, gloves and gowns, and interestingly though, they were told not to change the respiratory protection for aerosol-generating procedures, which certainly in our country, if we'd used masks, we would have changed protection. Next slide. So what did they find? Well, certainly they'd good follow-up, both clinically and also laboratory-wise. And what's quite interesting, I've just marked this in red, is how poor the vaccination status was of all the nurses that took part, the 30 and 28%. That's pretty similar to what it is in my hospital, though it has got better. And they were comparable in terms to rates of exposure outside the hospital. Next slide. So they found that the incidence of laboratory-confirmed influenza was similar between the two groups, and there was no significant difference between them in the incidence of influenza-like illness or infection with respiratory viruses. Next slide. So they concluded that surgical masks were no worse than N95. And the fact that the attack rate was similar may suggest that small aerosols didn't dominate transmission. So they recommended, really, in routine healthcare settings, that surgical masks were non-inferior and could protect workers. Next slide. There was a Cochrane review earlier this year, but it looked at all respiratory viruses, not just flu. But I thought it was quite interesting because they did make the point that to contain respiratory viral spread, you were back to your risk controls, including your standard precautions like hand washing. And they found limited evidence that N95 were superior to simple surgical masks. And notably, they were more expensive, certainly, absolutely, in my country, uncomfortable and caused skin irritation. Now, remember, that was all respiratory viruses. Slide 72. So their conclusion was quite interesting, and it was kind of brings me to the point of this talk that many simple and low-cost interventions are probably more useful, and it's back to those hierarchy of risk controls. It's not all about masks, and it's all to do with implementing the higher risk controls in a consistent basis. Slide 73. This is a paper from the Lancet Infectious Diseases, and I liked this diagram because it shows that it's not just about personal protective equipment. You have to consider availability, the disease transmission itself. I've already shown you evidence that certain strains will transmit easier than others. Compliance with personal protective equipment. There's not much point in having lots of fancy respirators if nobody knows how to use them and they don't fit properly. And also cost, because I don't know about in your country, but certainly in my country with the recession, cost is a very important factor. Having said that, patients and staff need to be kept safe. Next slide. The other important point that this paper raised is the importance of source control and the importance of placing surgical masks on coughing patients. And that's really important, but sometimes that's very difficult to do if you've got an unwell patient that's gasping for air. And the second paragraph on this slide I thought was very pertinent, and I'll read it out. Finally, healthcare workers can wear powerful air purifying respirators, eye protection, gowns, gloves when exposed to patients. But even if they are properly removed their protective equipment, they can become infected from colleagues who work with influenza-like symptoms. So I think it's really important that we have to gain perspective on our risk controls, and masks are important, but those top four are much more. Practical issue number six, since we're talking about masks, really is supplies. And it wasn't just in Ireland. Certainly a SHEA member survey showed that in North America, people had difficulty obtaining masks, both N95 and surgical masks, and a small percentage of people had difficulty obtaining alcohol hand rub. And certainly in my country, most pharmacies sold out of alcohol hand rub. Next slide, slide 77. This is an interesting paper that looks at the concept of planning. And I'm skipping a little bit, but I thought it was important to present because we've learned a little bit about masks and we've learned about the fact there's going to be a bit of a demand in it. And this paper explored what happened in Canada during the season in June to December 2009. And not surprisingly, facial protective equipment doubled and the use of disposable eyewear doubled, as did absenteeism. And they said that planners really should prepare for at least a doubling in the mask and respirator use. And also, more interestingly, to prepare for a 3.5-fold increase in staff sick calls. Now, practically, that's going to be a difficult issue if we've got a lot of staff off. So 78, slide 78 is an important practical issue, number seven. What do you do when guidelines differ? Now, we're skipping a little bit back to early in the pandemic, and I'm back to my national hat. So slide 79 shows you what I was faced with in Ireland. In Ireland, I knew that CDC, early in the pandemic, had said, use respirators. WHO had said, use a surgical mask, as did HICPAC, apart from aerosol-generating procedures. My colleagues in England went with respirators, and the European Centre of Disease Control went with surgical masks, but respirators for aerosol-generating procedures. Slide 80. It's very easy when we know it all at the end. And in September 2010, CDC advocated a multifaceted approach and talked that really about it was really predominantly droplet spread. Slide 81. So what do we do in Ireland? We actually initially did go with respirators because we weren't sure. But it became very, very clear that we were having a lot of issues, not only with supplies, but also the lack of fit testing. WHO issued their guidance, and we went with WHO issues, droplet precautions, except for aerosol-generating procedures. But we had lots of issues. Supplies, the quality of the face masks. Some hospitals got builders' face masks, which aren't very useful. Lots of training and education about respirators. And to be perfectly honest, there was far too much focus on masks. And that's why we tried to keep hammering home the hierarchy of risk controls. And there was lots of documentation surrounding all of this. So slide 82 just gives you an example of how we tried to get the message out of masks, but this is when you need to use respirators. And it was quite interesting to explore what exactly an aerosol-generating procedure was. And I don't think I've ever thought so much about aerosol-generating procedures in my life until the pandemic. So we're nearly there, guys, and thank you for your attention. So in summary, slide 83. Slide 84 to me says it all. I think it's really important. I found this so useful in the middle of all the panic to stand back and say, what is the hierarchy of risk controls? Stop talking about masks. Number one, have we considered elimination? If not substitution, can we do it? Number three, what about isolation and engineering controls? Number four, have we got all our administrative controls in line? And lastly, okay, now we can talk about masks. So from a practical end of things, and I'm a practical person because I think we have to adapt, be practical in infection control because we don't live in an ideal world. Practical point number one is it is not all about masks. Personal protective equipment has to be considered as the last line of defence in a hierarchy of infection control measures. Now, having said that, a single JAMA study, while it was very useful, certainly will not end the debate over respiratory protection for healthcare workers because we don't still know what is the predominant mode of transmission. And there's a huge amount of debate in the literature about this. And I really do think that focusing on masks distracted attention, certainly early on, from the critical importance of implementing other strategies that are known to prevent transmission. Now, speaking of masks, we need to prioritise use. Certainly in my country, we had to, because we had supply issues. There were certainly delays in diagnosis, and there was this fit testing and checking programme so that staff would wear them correctly that we had to implement pretty fast. Slide 86. We really need to make sure there's enough respirators for when we really need them, like aerosol-generating procedures and also all the other patients that come in with diseases like TB. Number four point is education, and it's education, education, and education. It's so difficult, even outside of flu, to get everybody to implement standard precautions all the time and to wear personal protective equipment appropriately. And yes, of course, audits are very, very important, but in the middle of a pandemic, it's not easy to do. Practical issue number five is, well, how do you improve? How can we improve staff vaccine uptake? Like, the case for mandatory vaccination is pretty compelling when you look at the evidence. But can you really force healthcare workers to get a vaccine? How can we improve hand hygiene? We all know we should do it. We have 5 moments, and yet we know that healthcare workers are not good at doing this right. How do we improve communication? Even in my country, while everybody's first language was English, there was times you would doubt that because communication could be poor, and it's generally because everybody was busy. Document control is a huge issue, and certainly for the next flu pandemic, we have to get that better. And burnout is a big issue, because you can work 29 hours a day, 10 days a week, but eventually you'll crash. So lessons for the future. Well, this is quite interesting, the SHE members survey. It reflects certainly what I found in my hospital and a lot of my other colleagues found. We really found that other important infection prevention activities were neglected. We're, in fairness, we're a bit like butter covering bread. Eventually, the butter will run out, and that's what we all felt like in the middle of the pandemic, because the other patients didn't stop coming in. Patients still got Clostridium difficile infection, patient came in with TB, patients came in with MRSA. So we had to deal with this also. The SHE members survey noticed lots of shortages, antivirals and the respirators. And also there was the issue of personal stockpiling. We don't have evidence of that from Ireland, but I'm sure we're no different. Interestingly, the majority of the SHE members agreed with the mandatory flu vaccine. And certainly, in terms of future initiatives, the SHE members wanted to prioritise vaccine development, healthcare worker education, and certainly revision of our plans. And all I can say as a parting note is we've all lived through one pandemic. Hopefully when, and not if, the next one hits, we will be better the next time. So I can conclude going on to the last slide, which shows the illustrious company that I will be keeping in the next month. And thank you very much for your attention. And I think I'm well on time, so I'll hand back over to Martin over the Irish Sea.
Thank you so much, Vedoma. Such a practical and comprehensive guide. You comprehensively covered all the issues arising from the pandemic, and I particularly found the risk hierarchy. Although we often think we plan our way through a problem, that risk hierarchy is such a useful tool that can be applied to so many infection prevention and control scenarios. It only reminds me to thank Vedoma and to thank you for joining us for this Weber Training teleclass. As ever, I give my thanks to Paul for facilitating these impressive events. Can I remind you that the next two teleclasses will be transmitted live next week from the Infection Prevention Society conference, when Anne Bielachowski, the past president, the immediate past president of CHICA Canada, will be speaking to us, and to Liam Donaldson, the chair of the World Health Organization Patient Safety Group. And also, if you're still interested in influenza, on the 29th of September, there's a session on nosocomial transmission of influenza and healthcare worker vaccination presented by Dr. Helena Maltzio from the Hellenic Center for Disease Control and Prevention in Greece. I hope you've enjoyed today's session, and I hope you all have a very good day. Thank you.